ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, fire crews in Western Victoria work to save homes as high winds and soaring temperatures take hold. Also, does the corporate world have a bad habit of only giving women the chance to lead in times of trouble? And here's a feral animal you weren't expecting, peacocks causing trouble in a small town in the Top End.
Then we saw a bunch of them, pretty much like a family, and they are usually in the front of our door, like every morning, staring at us.
First tonight to the bushfire emergency in Victoria. Evacuation warnings now apply to more than 30 towns in the state's west as a large out-of-control bushfire burns near Ararat. Fierce winds and high temperatures have fire crews under pressure and homes are under threat. Our reporter Natalie Whiting is in Beaufort and she joins us now. Nat, what can you see? What's happening where you are now?
Well, this is an incredibly fast-moving fire, Sam. There's a lot of smoke. At one point, we've had a smoke column that emergency services tell us was 10 kilometres high. So this fire started in bushland, but it has been growing quite quickly. The concern now with that big smoke column is the fact that this can be creating its own weather system, that it could start lightning, that could start other fires. The other concern for emergency services at the moment is the spot fires. We are seeing spot fires hundreds of metres ahead of the fire front. So this has been developing very quickly. Earlier, we were in the town of Raglan. It's now one of the 30 where people have been given the emergency warning to evacuate, to leave their homes. We were there as that warning was coming through and, you know, people were had the hoses out, wetting down the roofs of their homes. They'd packed what they could into their cars. We saw some horse trailers, some caravans as everyone was heading out of town. And the fireys that were on the ground there, I had a chat to them and they were all very concerned, just keeping an eye on the wind change. We've got sort of more than 50 vehicles responding. We've got aircraft in the sky all doing what they can to try to bring this blaze under control.
And Nat, as I said, more than 30 towns now on high alert, people being urged to evacuate. What are some of the other locations on that list?
Yes, that's right. It started initially when this fire went to an emergency warning. It was just a handful of small communities around that initial blaze, which is sort of just east of Ararat. But that has grown significantly. As I say, towns like Raglan, where I am, Beaufort, will be pulling back to Ballarat. Beaufort has also now been included. It's got some smoke over it now and a lot of people here. The town is like a ghost town. Everyone's shut up the shops. There's some residents who are staying, but a lot who have gone. And it seems to be being used as something of a staging area for some of the crews. There's quite a few vehicles here, a few trucks that are heading back and forth. But Beaufort now also included Brewster, Lexington. There's quite a few towns here, 30 nearby communities. So everyone at the moment is now being told to head to Ballarat, that is going to be the safest point. They're setting up some relief centres. Earlier in the day, the relief centre was here in Beaufort, but as the intensity of this fire has increased and the danger has spread, they've now shifted that back to Ballarat. So people in those affected communities around this blaze in Ararat are being told safest to get out and get to the relief centre that's being established at Ballarat.
And Nat, as you say, you're in the thick of it and it's often hard to keep track of, but what are you hearing in terms of the weather that's expected tonight? Just how severe is the danger over the next few hours?
Well, as I say, it's quite difficult now. The emergency services are concerned about the potential of this fire creating its own weather systems. This has been a bit of a peak period here where they were concerned about southerly changes. And I know that at the moment it's burning in a southeasterly direction, but any wind change could affect some of these towns. And I know that some of the firefighters on the ground were saying that to me as well. So they're certainly keeping an eye on the weather. And, you know, we have got some storm cells moving through the state more broadly, but very difficult when you get the sort of smoke plume that we have at the moment, that sort of column. And as I've said, with the spot fires as well. So certainly keeping an eye on the weather change. And I know some of the fireys were concerned about a change.
Take care, Nat. Thanks very much for that update. Our reporter, Natalie Whiting, speaking to me from Beaufort in Victoria's West. And just a reminder, if you are in one of the affected areas in the west of Victoria, do stay tuned to your local ABC radio for the latest updates. Well, now to international news. And this Saturday marks the second anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The United Nations recently described it as the gravest armed conflict in Europe since the Second World War, and there's no end in sight. The exact death tolls are hard to confirm, but the losses for both sides have been extremely high, in the hundreds of thousands. Tomorrow evening, we're going to take a look at the war from the Ukraine perspective. But for an insight into what's happening in Russia, David Lipson spoke to international relations analyst Dr. Bobo Lowe from the Lowy Institute.
There's a fair degree of momentum with Russia. That doesn't mean that it's going to win a decisive military victory anytime soon. But certainly the military advantage is with Russia. Part of the problem is that Ukraine is not getting the equipment that it needs to defend its position and to actually ultimately prevail in the war. The main problem here is a lack of ammunition, but there are also other military and political and economic issues as well.
Russia's military has sustained heavy losses in the past 2 years in blood and treasure. What's the best assessment in regards to how Russia's military is coping?
The Russian military, you're right, has absorbed enormous losses. According to some estimates, fairly conservative estimates, the Russians have lost 315,000 people in dead and wounded. But the thing is, they can always replenish these losses. So the Russian military is rolling on, so to speak. It's absorbing losses that would be completely unacceptable in any Western military, for example. But they are continuing. There is no sign of any scaling down of a conflict. There's no sign of Putin seeking a compromise. He certainly, at this stage, looks to be fancying his chances very much indeed.
What about the sanctions, the economic sanctions? There was a lot of cooperation in the West to put in place these sanctions against Russia. But Putin is still getting weapons from North Korea and Iran. The economy there, though dented, it hasn't collapsed. Have the sanctions worked in your view?
It depends what you understand by the purpose of sanctions. A lot of people who criticise sanctions fail to consider the alternative. If the West hadn't imposed sanctions, effectively they would have been saying, you go right ahead. What you do with Ukraine is not our problem. So the West had to do something. Having said that, the sanctions have not proved as effective as Western leaders hoped. I actually think that many of their expectations were inflated. It really never was going to change Putin's decision making. And I think the West is making a fundamental strategic error here. They are focused mainly on punishing Russia, whereas the emphasis has to be on supporting Ukraine. And Western support, for all the orgy of Western self-congratulation about resolve and unity, Western support has been too little, too slow, too late. And in this sense, Putin's calculation has been justified, because Putin, from the outset, has always thought that the West would not have the stomach and the nerve to see the struggle out. And unfortunately, recent developments suggest that he may well be justified in thinking that.
Now, it's notoriously difficult to accurately gauge public opinion in Russia. But what's our best guess about what Russians think of this war? And is there any hint, even a sniff, of the sort of opposition that would require Vladimir Putin to change course?
I think most Russians would like the war to end, but they want it to end on Russia's terms. So there's no pressure on the regime to compromise. The Russian public, in a sense, have got used to the war. And they're also, they bought into the sort of regime narrative of it's not just Russia versus Ukraine, it's Russia versus the West. In other words, it's an existential war that we must win, whatever the sacrifices are involved. And so this is a problem, really. The public will, but especially the political will in Russia to continue the war is far greater than the will of Western governments in the West to support Ukraine. And this, I don't think, will change. In any event, even if there were some degree of public discontent, no one, frankly, is game to protest against the regime.
Is the apparent murder of opposition figure Alexei Navalny and failed coup plotter Yevgeny Prigozhin a sign of Putin's strength or weakness?
Let's separate them out. So the original Prigozhin mutiny against Putin was a real shock to the regime. And the regime's response initially was certainly one of weakness. Putin looked more fragile than he had done for more than two decades. But the actual killing of Prigozhin, or at least we think it was him, and then the murder of Alexei Navalny actually shows that the regime feels pretty good about its chances. So it's very much, especially the Navalny murder, a reflection of how Putin feels about his strength. In a sense, his attitude has been very much one of, I can, therefore I will. There's nothing the West or anyone else can do to touch me, so I'm just going to keep on trucking on here.
Yeah, nothing we can do about it. What of the election next month, widely labelled a sham? What should we look out for there?
The election will essentially be a referendum, not just on Putin, but on the war. So Putin will want, not only, he'll win, obviously, in the first round. That's not the issue. The real issue is by how much. Now, you don't want to make the numbers too high, because then they don't appear credible, so to speak. So you don't want North Korean 99% type figures. But you do want a crushing mandate. So I would say you'd be looking at least 80% plus, possibly more. But the really crucial point is you want turnout to be very high too, because you don't want people to say, oh, well, look, people didn't show up at the polls, and therefore, you know, what people feel towards Putin is mainly indifference. What you want to show is high turnout, high outcome, and it shows that the Russian public are all the way with Vladimir Putin.
So just taking you back to the war in Ukraine, there have been various proposals put forward to end what appears to be an impasse, a stalemate. The Korean model, for example, which would include an armistice, no peace treaty, but Western security guarantees for Ukraine. Would Russia ever accept something like that?
Here's the problem. There is no peace that Putin will accept, except one that is overwhelmingly on the Kremlin's terms. So the only, what people often talk about off-ramps and compromise solutions, but the only off-ramp there is, viewed from the Kremlin, is effectively Ukraine's unconditional surrender. Mm. Now, for all the talk about ceasefire, how is that actually going to work? Well, for the Russians, they might look at a ceasefire in two ways. One way is to say, no, we've got momentum, let's keep grinding on. The other is, yes, let's take a ceasefire. The West will go home. They'll be preoccupied by other priorities. And we'll have another dip in 6 months' time. And there simply won't be any viable Western support, any worthwhile Western support for Ukraine. So let's have a go at that. The problem, you talk about guarantees. What guarantees? We've been down this path before. The only really reliable guarantee, well, the most reliable guarantee, is accelerated Ukrainian membership of the EU and of NATO. And unfortunately, the Europeans, and actually even the Biden administration, are dead set against this. They talk about a membership perspective for the EU. They talk about eventual membership of NATO for Ukraine. But this won't happen.
Dr. Bobo Lowe from the Lowy Institute speaking there to David Lipson. And I hope you can tune in tomorrow night when we'll be taking a look at the war from the Ukrainian perspective. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, why are so many female corporate leaders only being given the top job when there's a mess to clean up? A fight over fishing rights in Australia's far northern waters is intensifying, with commercial fishers, locals and conservationists at odds over possible bans on gill nets. The federal and Queensland governments have already announced gill net fishing will be banned on the Great Barrier Reef by mid-2027, and it's looking at doing the same in parts of the Gulf of Carpentaria. Commercial fishers say it's a devastating move, but locals and conservationists argue the impact of the gill nets is obvious and too many threatened species are at risk. This report from Stephanie Smale.
The rivers around the Kawanyama Aboriginal Shire on the west coast of Cape York can be a rich source of fish species like barramundi. But the mayor, Robbie Sands, says when commercial fishers use gill nets in waterways like Topsy Creek, the impact is obvious.
It's a very small tributary, and the impacts on the fishery, we can see that locally when we go out there fishing those areas after the pro fishermen set their nets and leave that area.
So you can see the impact that it has?
We can see the impact by when we're fishing out there, we hardly catch the good fish like the barramundi and the salmon and stuff.
Gill nets are long rectangular nets used to catch fish in the moving tide. Robbie Sands says his council has made a joint submission to the Queensland government with traditional owners from the region, calling for the practice to be paused.
We're asking to have some more of the rivers closed at this stage for 3 years, but ultimately we would like it closed permanently.
The Queensland and federal governments have already started phasing out gill net fishing on the Great Barrier Reef on the state's east coast. About half of the current gill net fisheries in the Gulf are under review now too. That includes all rivers and creeks, the area surrounding Mornington Island, and a large section off the northwest coast of the peninsula.
One morning you wake up and you've got a perfectly good business, and then by the afternoon you haven't got a job.
David Wren lives in the port town of Corumba, south of Kawanyama. He's been fishing grey mackerel in the Gulf for about 35 years. He also runs a business unloading boats and sending fish to other parts of Australia.
You know, we've been fighting this now for months and months and months. Our strategy was always to be for our grandchildren to keep fishing.
David Wren argues the commercial fishers in the Gulf are already working hard to improve sustainability, with measures like cameras on board to record fish takes. He argues political decisions are wiping out commercial fishing enterprises across the country.
I just did a drive from Adelaide to Cairns, and I called into ports all the way, and all I seen was dead boats, just some of them I don't even know how they're floating. After that drive, I realised that Corumba is one of the very, very, if not the last real commercial fishing town left in from Adelaide to Cairns. So it's pretty scary what they've done the whole coast.
David Wren argues reducing the amount of area that can be fished can hurt the environment too.
There's large, large sections of water that are already closed. You know, once you start closing more areas, unless you take fishermen out, all you're doing is condensing people into fishing areas harder. and that's not good for the fish stocks.
The conservationists say if managed in the right way, reducing gillnet fishing in the Gulf could help threaten species on both sides of Cape York. Dr. Leonardo Guida is a shark scientist at the Australian Marine Conservation Society.
So where the gillnet-free zones have been proposed in the Gulf of Carpentaria are habitats that are critical to the survival of a range of threatened species that use those coastal waters and the main river systems to breed and reproduce. And we're looking at critically endangered sawfish. We're looking at a range of turtle species that use these habitats that then actually travel around the Gulf and into the Great Barrier Reef. So protecting these areas from gillnet fishing helps reduce the mortality of a lot of threatened species. And we're not only making the Gulf waters healthier, but it also has those added benefits for the Great Barrier Reef on the East Coast as well.
The Queensland government says there have been thousands of submissions on the Gulf gillnet ban. In a statement, the Minister for Fisheries, Mark Ferner, says he's met with traditional owners, commercial and recreational fishers and local governments to discuss the issue. But he says no final decisions have been made.
Stephanie Smale reporting. Well, Australia hasn't had many female state leaders, but political commentators have observed they often take office when a government's on the slide and there's a mess to clean up. Now concerns are growing that top women executives are experiencing a similar fate and being thrown under what some are calling the corporate bus. Commentators point to recent appointees like the Reserve Bank Governor Michelle Bullock, the incoming Woolies boss Amanda Bardwell, and the Qantas CEO Vanessa Hudson. Our reporter David Taylor takes a look at the phenomenon dubbed the glass cliff.
Qantas CEO Vanessa Hudson wants to improve the airline's battered reputation. She spoke to the ABC during today's profit announcement inside a hangar at Sydney Airport.
I'm going to do the best I can, and there's a simple context that I provide, which is I'm spending more time listening, less time talking, but I'm also spending more time acting and less time promising. We're not done. We've got to keep going.
Qantas revealed a 13% fall in its half-year profit to $873 million. Vanessa Hudson now has the unenviable task of improving the airline's reputation and boosting profits in a cost-of-living crisis. And incoming Woolworths CEO Amanda Bardwell will take the top job against a backdrop of multiple parliamentary inquiries and a year-long pricing investigation. It's part of a trend that worries Amanda Rose. She's the head of Entrepreneurial and Small Business Women Australia, and she says women are increasingly being brought in to fix big corporate problems created by men.
Been like cascaded over the years, but the last year it seems to be just insane.
The phenomenon is known as the glass cliff, a term coined by Australian researcher Michelle Ryan. She found women were more likely to be appointed to leadership positions in times of crisis. Amanda Rose says in her experience, boards choose women in times of crisis in attempt to boost their corporate image or reputation.
They feel that people won't interrogate a female like they would a man, so they won't go as hard on the questioning. They also believe that women bring people together. So like with government in particular, they usually put a female in front because they'll bring the community together, especially when the community are turning on the male leader.
Isn't that a good thing?
Of course it's a good thing, but why wasn't she picked for that in the first place? Why do we have to have the male do what he's done and ruin the situation or turn the community off or make really poor decisions and then have the woman come and fix it? The woman's been there all along. Why wasn't she considered in the first place?
Peter Strong was involved with the Women's Economic Security Advisory Group during the Turnbull and Morrison governments. He argues women have greater scope to show their leadership capabilities by taking over troubled firms.
Taking over big businesses that are having trouble is what normally happens. It's only the lucky people that take over businesses that aren't having trouble, and they then struggle a bit to show how they've improved things. It's a real opportunity. It's a real opportunity.
Labour market expert Leonora Rees disagrees.
If you're stepping into a company that's in good shape, you're more likely, I guess, to be able to demonstrate your successful leadership skills compared to if you're stepping into a company that's in a really dire situation and you've got a lot more pressures and stress to contend with.
The Canberra University professor has spent her career analysing what works best for women who want to climb the corporate ladder in the same way as men.
There are these unknown barriers. In the field of economics, for example, we know that a lot of networking and connections, they operate in informal ways. They operate in after-work drinks or conversations amongst colleagues that are outside of formal channels. And that's how you build connections. That's how you develop project ideas. And that's certainly the case in academia as well. So I think the research helped alert me to the existence of those inequities and to figure out, well, what do we do to break them down, not just for my own career, but for women in my profession more broadly.
Canberra University economist Leonora Reese. David Taylor with that report. Well, you've probably heard of feral pigs and feral cats and the damage they do in the outback. But how about feral peacocks? About 30 of the creatures are wreaking havoc in the tiny Northern Territory town of Elliot. They're ruffling feathers so much that the council's now trialling an Adopt-a-Peacock program to find these bad birds loving homes. This report from Lillian Rangier.
On the Stuart Highway, smack bang between Darwin and Alice Springs, lies the tiny town of Elliot. Look in any direction from the town and there's nothing but red dirt and bush. So when Brazilian working holidaymaker Laura Goldman and her partner arrived 10 weeks ago, an ostentation of brilliant bright blue peacocks was the last thing they expected to see.
I was expecting some like lizards, these kind of animals like kangaroos. But these colourful animals, not at all. So it was a good surprise.
And it turns out they'd actually kept her up the night before.
Probably I listened to them, like in my roof. Then we saw a bunch of them, pretty much like a family. And they are usually in the front of our door, like every morning. Every day when we wake up, he was there staring at us.
Thousands of kilometres away from their native South Asian forests, peacocks and peahens have found some unlikely homes around Australia, from Darwin to remote WA. The origin of Elliot's peafowls is cloaked in mystery, but it's believed they were first brought to town in the 1990s. Mona Rennie, now in her 80s, is a jingly traditional owner. She's lived in Elliot for decades, and although she can't remember how the peafowls got there, they did make quite an impression.
It really was a surprise when they first came here. The people here, we didn't know what they were, what kind of birds they were.
Do you remember what their reaction was, or...?
I think a lot of the people were unhappy first when they first came here, you know.
What's clear is that they've spread their wings and multiplied ever since. While tourists can't get enough, Mona takes a different view.
Oh, they're nuisance. They dig up everything and they move around a lot, you know. They do make a lot of noise, but mainly they sleep on top of the trees, you know, the trees here. It's really fascinating too because they keep the snakes and that away from here. Yeah, from the children.
The council estimates there's around 30 peafowl living in Elliot at the moment, and local retiree Bob Bagnall says their impact is extreme.
They poop on the cars, they poop everywhere. The main street is a disgrace. It's everywhere, and they were just in one part of town around the caravan park. Now they're gradually going further and further out.
Bob raised the peacock problem at a meeting with the local council, who came up with a novel solution, putting the call out for an Adopt-a-Peacock program. In the words of the Barkly Regional Council's outgoing chief executive, Ian Bodle,
if anybody wants peacocks out there, we can help. We are removing some of them with EPA approval and they're going to be relocated to other spots. I know there's a lot in Madaranka and some people welcome them. I like the guinea fowl though, but yes, they are a lot. And one hopes it doesn't get to the point where you have to really cull them because they're fantastic things.
The council's since found adoptive homes nearby for 26 peacocks, and they're waiting for the birds to finish nesting before they relocate them. There's about four still looking for a home, so if you're interested, Laura Goldman can't recommend them strongly enough.
I think they are beautiful. I think they are like amazing animals, like probably the beautiful one that I have ever seen because it's so like so perfect, you know, so nature. Like you can feel the nature in him, yeah.
Lillian Reingear reporting from Elliot in the Northern Territory. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hello, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For more than a decade, Julian Assange has tried everything to avoid the position he finds himself in now, on the cusp of being bundled onto a plane to the US to face espionage charges. His fate now rests with a couple of judges in London. Today, media freedom advocate Peter Grester unpacks his case for us. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.